So I'm just going to talk a bit about my take on the Freudian self, which I think is, you know, I'll start with a caveat that I think it's kind of challenging to really get your head around exactly what Freud means with a lot of these things. So I'm going to, you know, do my take on it based on the reading that I've done, but I definitely came away thinking, oh, you know what, I should go and study this for a few more years. And maybe I'd understand. So Freud starts civilization and its discontents with, normally there is nothing of which we are more certain than the feeling of ourself. And of course then he proceeds to completely refute that statement at length. And so at its root, Freud's model of the self starts off with the base, the sort of base concept of the id, right? And what he postulates is in this id is that this sort of primitive, unconscious source of sort of passions and instincts and completely unconscious reactions to things in the world, right? And he seems to, although he doesn't necessarily, or didn't exactly come out and say this in the bits that I read, he does seem to imply that this is, in some sense, undifferentiated, at least within sort of racial, community, social lines, right? That maybe, you know, for me, as a sort of a white Australian, then, you know, I might have a very similar id to other white Australians, but maybe a very different one to some other race or culture. And that it's in, he actually uses the word genetic in some context, and I find that kind of interesting. He didn't really dig in, or at least in the bits that I read, he didn't really dig in as to whether he actually meant that in sort of the classic DNA sense, or it was kind of reflecting this racial shared sort of passions or reactions. He does definitely talk about that it is inherited, although again, whether or not that inheriting is through sort of social teachings as opposed to, you know, DNA is somewhat unclear to me at the moment. It's pretty clear that Freud doesn't think much of the id. He actually directly calls it evil in some contexts, and he sort of talks very negatively about the kind of unconstrained id, and, you know, is a much bigger fan of the ego, which is this layer on top, and he seems to come at it from a little bit of a brain model perspective in the terms of the multiple layers in the brain. And the ego consists of self-consciousness, your awareness, traditions, you know, social traditions, reason, common sense. And it's really at the ego level that Freud seems to imply that there's differentiation between individuals, you know, particularly within a specific culture. That's really what makes you, as opposed to the id, which is somewhat more shared. He also very much implies that the ego is learned, that this is something that you develop. And there's this sort of interaction between the ego and the id. The ego holds the id in check. The ego is the source of sort of the repression and the social niceties that kind of layer over our gut instincts and our drives and that sort of thing. This way, you know, we get social structures. This is how we're all nice to each other and don't just, you know, act very rationally and in not very nice ways all the time. And so this is really this veneer of civilization is coming from the ego. And so, you know, this would be a really nice, clean model, except that Freud, I think, really hedges his bets and starts to, like, just totally mishmash these together, right? So firstly, he says, the ego is not sharply separated from the id. Its lower portion merges into it. And he also says, the ego appears to us as something autonomous and unitary, marked off distinctly from everything else. That such an appearance is deceptive. And that on the contrary, the ego is continued inwards without any sharp delineation into an unconscious mental entity which we designate as the id, and for which it serves as a kind of facade. And so he actually sort of implies that the ego and the id sort of merge together, and that there is a component of the ego that is not conscious, merged in with the id, and that sort of, you know, you can just kind of assign randomly things to the id or the ego. He seems to kind of choose a little bit depending on what suits his argument best at any different point in time. And then he goes further. He actually states that the ego is then not clearly defined from the rest of the world, right? So the line between yourself and the world is not even clear, right? So thus, even the feeling of our own ego is subject to disturbances, and the boundaries of the ego are not constant. And so, you know, it does seem like he, as I say, hedges his bets a little bit in terms of like, oh, well, I'm not going to really clearly define any of the lines between this model, you know, the self, outside of the self, inside of the self, and then the ego versus the id. For example, he sort of talks about anxiety and the fight or flight reaction, which to me seems to be something that's a pretty base sort of instinctual reaction that I would sort of think, oh, that's part of the id, if I'm, you know, naively thinking about this model, and yet he explicitly calls that out as being part of the ego. So it's not maybe as clean as we might like. But that's kind of the model at its core. So then he goes further and introduces the concept of the ego ideal, or the superego. And this is a differentiation within the ego, so it's a component within the ego itself. And this is sort of somehow representing what you want to be like, what you think you should be like. You're sort of, you know, this is highly individual. It's very, very dependent on your parent. You know, very Freudian sort of concepts of parents and attachment from kind of early childhood. And so he says the ego is essentially the representation of the external world of reality. The superego stands in contrast as the representation of the internal world, the id. So basically the concept is the id is this like raw reaction. The ego is sort of the facade of rationality on top of that. And the superego is this sort of concept of, well, this is what I should be like, and this is how I like to think of my own id in a perfect world. And so, obviously, this model is not very unitary at all. There's all these different components, and they're all interacting in very, very strange ways. But there are some kind of, you know, we can think about this model of the self in some of the other sort of frames that we've talked about in class. So it's very clearly diachronic. He directly states that when you're born, when a baby is born, it's only id, and that the ego and the superego are sort of learned over time, and that this is... You know, he expressly says, further reflection tells us that the adult's ego feeling cannot have been the same from the beginning. He also implies very strongly that these layers are very, very dependent on the relationships and your interactions with others that you had from an early age. And there's actually some other stuff that he even talks about in terms of group dynamics and how groups can kind of impact this very from the outside, which is sort of, you know, he really seems to imply that a self is very determined by relationships and interactions rather than being very self-determined. He also actually directly sort of addresses some of the issues that we've talked about around selfhood. So he directly addresses intoxication, which I think is interesting. And so his idea of intoxication is that the ego is affected by the alcohol or whatever, and that the id is sort of running free at that point, that the repression is reduced from the alcohol, but and then the id just goes nuts, basically. He talks about sleeping, and the idea is that the ego and the id don't sleep, but the ego is actually repressing the id even during sleep, and that's where dreams come from, and this is where the whole sort of dream analysis theory and field evolved from. And he talks about, you know, obviously he's a psychoanalyst, and so he postulates that a lot of the psychological issues, depression, bipolar, etc., actually come from conflict between the ego and the superego. So, for example, if you're, you know, constantly, there's conflict between this idea of yourself that you should be, the superego, you know, is this sort of perfect thing that you think you should be, and it's in conflict with the ego, how you actually are, that's where depression comes from, for example. So that's my kind of model of what I think the Freudian self is. I think the core concept that there's all this unconscious stuff that you know, we're not really aware of is actually pretty profound, but I think there's some crazy stuff in there too. And that's my time. I won't go into that.
Great.
Confessing that I did find it a little bit intimidating to tackle Freud, so maybe Proust would have been a better choice. But I'd never read him in his original works before, and I confess when I read sentences like the transformation of the object libido into narcissist libido, which thus takes place, obviously implies the abandonment of sexual aims. Some of those sentences were a little less obvious to me at first, but I did stick with it and came to enjoy Freud. So for this discussion, I focused on civilization and its discontents. And my claim is that while Freud stops short of concluding that civilization is and always will be incompatible with happiness of man, that is because he stops short of the natural conclusion of his arguments. And indeed, if you're to subscribe to Freud's theories about the development of the self and the nature of civilization, you must believe that sustained happiness is impossible. So I'll start by recapping what Freud said about civilization and then describe three arguments that I think justify a more pessimistic conclusion than the one he came to. So what does Freud say exactly? He allows that a man will find difficulties with civilization. Page 752, we may expect greatly to carry through such alterations in our civilization as will better satisfy our needs, but perhaps we may also familiarize ourselves with the idea that there are difficulties attaching to the nature of civilization that will not yield to attempted reform. So maybe there are some aspects of civilization that we just can't improve. He goes on to specify that man's natural aggressiveness is one of those challenges. And page 755, the inclination to aggression is an original self-substituting instinctual disposition in man, and I return to my view that it constitutes the greatest impediment to civilization. He ends civilization and its discontent stopping short of a definitive prognosis for our welfare. On page 772, he asks, the fateful question for the human species seems to be whether and to what extent their cultural development will succeed in mastering the human instinct of aggression and self-destruction. But who can foresee what success and with what result? So Freud is acknowledging that there are real challenges with civilization for man, but he says it's impossible to determine how it will turn out. However, building up from his arguments, I think it's necessary to take a more pessimistic view, and I'll draw from his comments in three areas. First, his theory of the development of the individual and the id, ego, and superego. Second, his view on the nature of happiness. And third, his dismissal of the ideal, love thy neighbor as thyself, as an impractical impossibility. So first, the nature of the individual, which Kathy so well described. So the Freudian self is dichotomic and ununified. We begin as an id, a bundle of instincts and desires, and then a superego develops, the voice of our parents or of society in our head, telling us that our desires are wrong and dirty. And then the ego, which has the not so enviable job of mediating between the id and the superego, trying to satisfy both. And so, thus, as you pointed out, we do evolve over time. Our psychology as a baby is not the same as our psychology as an adult. But the outcome of this development is never the unification of the id, ego, and superego into one. The tension between them will remain. And on page 770, he says, even in what we know as normal people, the id cannot be controlled beyond certain limits. So as we enter into civilization for benefits of protection, we try and develop rules that will lead to our happiness. But the rules that will lead to my happiness will be different from the ones that lead to yours, because you've had different experiences leading to different subconscious desires. And in civilization, some of our desires will be outside of the rules. So page 742, Freud notes, "It is not easy to understand how it can become possible to deprive an instinct of satisfaction. If the loss is not compensated for economically, one can be certain that serious disorders will result." So civilization and our instincts, our id, which isn't going to go away anytime soon because of our nature, will always be at odds, leading to our dissatisfaction. The second argument is based on what Freud says about the nature of happiness. And Freud examines some possible sources of happiness: quietness, drugs, beauty, religion, love, and comes up short in identifying anything that can cause true and constant happiness. Even love isn't the answer, because you'll be very hurt when the thing that you love disappears. And even if love were to last, its ability to cause sustained happiness would lessen. On page 727, "When any situation that is desired by the pleasure principle is prolonged, it only produces a feeling of mild contentment. We are so made that we cannot derive intense enjoyment from but only from a contrast of, and very little from the state of things. Thus, our possibilities of happiness are already restricted by our constitution." So if you're lucky enough to find love or find happiness, according to Freud, it won't keep you happy for very long. So further complicating our quest for happiness and intensifying the conflict with civilization is Freud's view that what brings us greatest happiness, about what brings us greatest happiness. And on page 731, he says, "The feelings of happiness derived from the satisfaction of wild instinctual impulses untamed by the ego is incomparably more intense than the derived of sating instincts that have been tamed." So, bad luck. The greatest happiness comes from the things you shouldn't be doing. And this sets up an irreconcilable tension between civilization and the pursuit of happiness. The third and final reason for greater pessimism is that Freud's dismissal of the ideal "love thy neighbor as thyself" as an impractical impossibility. So Freud says, rather narcissistically, that if your neighbor that your neighbor may be unworthy of love unless he is somehow better than you. Page 748. "If I love someone, he must deserve it in some way, and he deserves it if even so much as he is more perfect than myself, and thus I can love my ideal of my own self in him." And as Freud says, his neighbor is unlikely to have the least trace of love for me. As an aside, apparently Freud was not known as a very nice person, so perhaps that's a reflection on his personal experiences with his neighbors. So anyway, reading these passages, and this is where I came to like Freud, I started to conjure him as this image of the anti-hippie showing up at Woodstock, perhaps high on cocaine instead of marijuana, saying something like, "You know, I just can't love you, brother. Not going to happen." So Freud goes on to say, "I think I can now hear a dignified voice," his superego perhaps, "admonishing me, it is precisely because your neighbor is not worthy of love and because he is, on the contrary, your enemy, that you should love him as yourself." But he dismisses this idea as simply absurd. So where does this leave us? Well, I think we're pretty stuck. Turning our back on civilization, becoming a hermit, or living in a fantasy does not make us happy, either, according to Freud. So in conclusion, rather than some aspects of civilization being in tension with happiness, I believe that Freud's view of the individual implies that civilization will always inadequately fulfill our demands for happiness. We have an id that will never master and isn't going away. Happiness is fleeting and also greatest when it is illicit. And the idea that tensions in society can be redressed by loving your neighbor is absurd. So Freud titles his book Civilization and Its Discontents, but perhaps you'll agree that following the logic of his arguments, a better title might be perhaps Civilization is Discontent.
All right, be hard to match that. You guys. But before I get into my analysis of Freud, I want to bring out a word that I thought was pretty interesting and describes my relationship to this course, which Freud actually brought up, a word called shibboleth. A word sound custom that person unfamiliar with its significance may not pronounce or perform correctly. So if I'm not able to pronounce a certain word, please tell me and Jeremy can help me. So the way I have done Freud is I've looked at five different aspects. So first try to define what's his definition of self, and then what's the relationship of the self with the religion, and then what's the human behavior and the purpose of the human life according to Freud, and the relationship of the self with the nature and the God, and finally the relationship with the civilization. So I'll go in each one of those one by one. By reading two articles that we were supposed to read, I must admit that the first one, Ego and Id, was very difficult for me to read for some reasons. I had to actually apply Descartesian principle on that forget everything and then just think about philosophy. It was very hard for me to do that. But anyway, from that what I gathered was that according to Freud, he views self as a multi-tiered entity which contains conscious and self-conscious. I'm sorry, unconscious. And consciousness refers to mental thoughts of which we are aware, and unconsciousness, on the other hand, refers to the mental process which we are usually not aware of. But then he goes on to say that unconscious self is dominating influence on our lives, and the reason for that is because it contains all the basic and primal instincts, including sexuality, aggressiveness, and our bent towards self-destruction. On the other hand, the conscious self, the purpose of it is to help us act rationally and appropriately so that we can function practically in the harmony with the social environment. So that's how he describes it, and that sort of comes from the Ego and Id reading. In the civilization and its discontent also, he comes out and says that our psyche is layered. He gives out an example of how Rome is built upon the ruins of past Romes. And similarly, our emotions are also stratified because of that, just like that. So what is inside us, that's the past, and below the other layers, it lives on and informs us about its presence and what the above is. The other thing which I found, which kind of on a metaphysical level from Freud's perspective, was that he obviously recognizes that the ego is the self. Ego is actually what defines the self. But at the same time, ego, internally it may meld with it, but externally it has a very clear demarcation. When at the height of love, these boundaries tend to melt. And what he's trying to say over there is, or at least what I understand what he's trying to say over there is that that our as a defined self, which is our ego, and its relationship to the environment around us and the world around us, starts to sort of meld into one when we are in these states of height of like love and those are things that create those, sort of breaks those boundaries. Otherwise, ego, according to him, is a very demarcated self. One more thing which I found kind of relevant to his definition of self, he says that man is not a gentle creature. He's actually a creature with instincts to be reckoned as power share of aggressiveness. And that kind of defines what the self self is. And actually, when we go into discussion about the civilization, there's a lot of influence on that, the fact that aggressiveness and how to contain that and how that this interaction with Eros it creates the civilizations. So with that, let me move on to the relationship with the religion. Freud comes out and clearly says that religion are mass delusions. He does that when he's describing that how human beings, while trying to suppress or avoid unhappiness, they create worlds around them which are delusional. And he goes out to say that religion does exactly the same thing in order to avoid these pains and unhappiness. Religion creates those delusions around us. As a matter of fact, he goes out and says that what religion does, it creates its own path for the acquisition of the happiness. But in doing so, it distorts the value of the life for people, for the individuals. But the good thing about that is that it succeeds in sparing many people from individual neurosis, which is what sort of intoxicating about the religion he describes, which according to him is a delusion. I think in the context of religion, another thing that he talked about, which was pretty interesting, I thought, is what his friend talked about. He calls it's a sensation of eternity, a feeling of something limitless, unbounded, as it were oceanic. Freud clearly does not believe or does not feel that oceanic feeling. By the same time, he goes out and describes that just like a baby when he grows up, originally he can't differentiate between external world and what his ego is. But as he grows up, he starts to make those differentiation, and that's how the ego starts apart from the rest of the world. But then there are a whole bunch of people out there who do not make that transition. They continue to live like that in infants, where there is a continuity between the ego and the rest of the world. And that's, according to him, gives that oceanic feeling. But at the same time, he comes back and says, well, that may be true that some people do get the oceanic feeling, but that does not mean that those feelings are religious. So he constantly denies the religion as something real. He considers it a delusional act. One more thing really interesting in context of religion he brings out is the antithesis of religion with the art and sciences. And what he says is when it comes to the value of life, the achievements that human beings have, which is arts and sciences, can be replaced with the religion and vice versa. In the context of the human behavior and the purpose of life, he says that life is too hard and it brings too many pains. So what's human nature is essentially is to strive for happiness. And then there are ways he describes of how to achieve that happiness. At the same time, as both of you pointed out, he does see that happiness is not something that is constant and can be achieved in the long term. He actually sees happiness as episodic. On the other hand, he sees unhappiness as something that is easier to experience. So then he goes out and talking about ways of how to avoid unhappiness rather than trying to achieve happiness, but how to avoid unhappiness, which is, as a corollary sort of gives you happiness, is what his thinking is. And it gives various ways of doing that, including voluntary isolation, becoming a member of human community where you attack the science, attack the nature, intoxication, killing the instinct as prescribed in yoga, attempt to control instinctual life. A couple of interesting things that we mentioned, which I think is a displacement of libido, and what he talks about is when artists and scientists, they themselves can overcome this unhappiness because they have the joy of creating art, and scientists have the pleasure of solving problems. But then obviously it's not something that everybody can do. Only people who have those capabilities can do that. But then for those people who don't have capabilities to do that, then he says then you can create delusions, which is sort of enjoy the art and sort of create create a delusion around yourself in the art itself, which is easier for people to see. Okay, I'm running out of time, so I'm going to go for a couple of time. So in terms of relationship with the nature, he says that advances in the natural sciences and technical application established the control that human beings have over nature. And rather than nature influencing human being, but humans are actually, or rather self is actually making Earth serviceable by its their own science and inventions and other achievements. As a matter of fact, the interesting thing that he comes out and mentions is that is human beings created a concept of omnipotence and omniscience, God. But over time, he himself, with the help of science and art, has become so close to attaining all these ideals that he has created about God that he himself is becoming God. So those are his. He thinks that self has that kind of relationship with art, with nature, and the God. Finally, the relationship with the civilization. So what he says, he postulates that there are three things: beauty, cleanliness, and order, that occupy a special position in the formation of civilization. But there is no other character better than man's higher mental activities and his intellectual, artistic, and scientific achievements that describes civilization better than anything else. Then he talks about that civilization is actually built upon renunciation of instincts, and human beings by nature have two kinds of instincts that he talks about. One is instinct for aggressiveness, and that leads to death instinct, which is destruction of not himself, but destruction of things around them. And in that context, I think he talks about neighbor as well, and he says neighbor is really an object to satisfy that aggressiveness and his sexual feelings. I thought it was a little, I don't know which neighborhood he lives in. and then finally he goes on and says that it's always possible to bind together a considerable amount of people in love as long as there are enough people left to receive the manifestation of this aggressiveness. And he gives an example of Apostle Paul, and then he says that how Apostle Paul posited the universal love between men as a foundation of Christian community, of extreme intolerance of Christian but towards those who remain outside the religion. So it kind of gives an example that how people with love can come together and you can form either groups and communities or nations and things like that. But then there has to be something outside that all the aggressiveness energy sort of has to be manifested on. And he talks about Jews as well and how they are that target for that manifestation of aggressiveness. Now I'll close on by saying that according to him, that aggressiveness or aggression constitutes the greatest impediment for civilization. But Eros, on the other hand, combines the individuals and the families and the races and peoples and the nations, according to Freud, which is the unity of the mankind. And then this is the constant. It's a constant balancing between these two instincts, or the struggle between these two instincts, Eros and the death, is what leads to formation of the and survival of the civilizations.
All right. Thank you. Okay, I'm not going to agree on time. What do we write down your thoughts for Rajiv, and we're going to have to start by responding to presentations next week. Is that all right?
Sure. I wish I'd listened to these three before I read Freud.
Yeah.
It would make more sense. Yeah. I'll go back and read it now.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Yeah, thank you. It was wonderful.
So maybe
yeah. Okay, so try to write down your thoughts so you can pick up from where we were. And we'll do our best to kind of quickly walk away from the Freud next week, so we should have some good time to discuss on Wolf next week. And just the one that we're going to make a pitch for how to read Virginia Woolf's novel. How many of you have read this novel before? Is this new for all of you? Well, good. How many of you have never read any Virginia Woolf? Wow, what a treat. Well, this is... there's a lot of competition for Virginia Woolf's greatest work, but I think this is, I would put it at number one, but she has a lot of great, great books. This book, I would say, like many of the things we've been reading, was not written with our class in mind. So Virginia Woolf is not setting out to answer the question, what is the self in this book? Although I think one of the clear questions that you're going to get from the novel is that Virginia Woolf seems very concerned about how to represent consciousness. So how to write down what goes through our minds, how to represent that experience of thinking. So like many of the modernists, like who read a little bit of Joyce in the first night, she's experimenting with stream of consciousness style writing. She's trying to figure out how to represent writing things which don't necessarily are conducive to writing, and so she's trying to invent new ways of trying to express that. One of the ways you might tackle this book is to try to figure out whose head are we in? Are we always in someone's head? Are we floating above someone? Are we between people? Do we move around? So try to figure out kind of who the speaker is. That's maybe a first approach, especially in this first part of the novel. And then, so thinking about that question about she's clearly trying to figure out how to represent to us the nature of our kind of internal experience, that's, I think, where we need to look for trying to work backwards and try to get a picture of what Woolf means by the self. That should be our primary question. But you'll remember that one of the reasons we got Woolf into the syllabus is we were trying to figure out if gender changes our picture of the self. Have we been meaning drawing a picture of what it is to be a male self so far? So this should also, although we're only reading one book and it's not a very good comparison to just throwing one book, but Woolf is clearly interested in the differences between men and men. That's an object of concern for her in all of her books. Many of the books. So you might try to pay attention to that as well. Is she trying to say that the self is gendered? That there is such a thing as a male way of being a self and a female way of being a self? Is that important to her writing, for example, about Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey in the first part of the novel? The novel is short but hard. If you were to skip something, you could theoretically skip the middle part, but it's only 20 pages, so it doesn't seem very much. But I'll warn you in advance that the second part, which is very short, is very confusing. The first and the third parts you're going to think are confusing enough, but the middle part is really deeply confusing. And I think, as fascinating as it is to the kind of meaning of the book overall, it's probably the least important for our work in trying to figure out what it means by itself. I might be proven wrong by our presenters next week, but if you were to place value on your reading, I try to figure out what kinds of things she is doing in parts one and three. In some ways, they're very similar in one and three, but they focus on different characters. So that might help you in your reading. Don't be worried about spending a lot of time early on. If you work hard on the initial parts of the novel, I think that will pay off. But try to get to the end. Okay? All right. Good discussion today, guys.